Halting half a mile down the lee side of the pass, we nibbled our lunches of crackers, cheese, and chocolate, washing them down with hot soup and chlorinated water. Our porters also paused for lunch. They pulled small wooden bowls from underneath their garments and partially filled them with white barley flour, which they carried in yakskin pouches fastened to their belts. Then, adding water from the nearby stream, they kneaded the uncooked mixture into what looked like thick mashed potatoes. Each porter took a bit of this dough-like paste, rolled it into a small ball and ate it with relish. This is tsamba, the staple national dish of Tibet. Our porters ate tsamba morning, noon and night, mixing it whenever they could with chang, Tibetan barley beer. Barley, by the way, is the main crop of Tibet, and almost the only grain that is grown successfully on the roof of the world. We continued to walk down the Tibetan side of Nathula. In the Himalayas one always dismounts going down any respectable slope, for there's an old Tibetan saying which you are expected to keep in mind: if he doesn't carry you uphill, he is no horse, and if you don't walk down, you are no man. The trail now led through a forest of pine and fir, past great patches of alpine flowers that spread their gay colors in all directions like the waves of a rainbow sea. At last our destination loomed up through the rain, the comfortable and very welcome dak bungalow of Champithong, perched at an elevation of 13,350 feet. We were over the great Himalayan barrier inside Tibet at last. As we shoved off with our caravan next morning, we waved farewell to John Roberts, who had to turn back at this point. He disappeared up the trail with a heavy heart, returning to India with all the tape recordings that we had made thus far. Dad and I continued down into the Chumbi Valley, bound for Tibet's fourth largest town, Yatung. The sun finally broke through, giving us a wonderful view of the valley, with the Amu River winding past golden green fields and little villages of white houses. We descended through the forest, where every tree was draped gracefully with a delicate golden moss, not the heavy, almost strangling variety found in our own deep south. In the forest we met our first Tibetan monkey. A big white fellow, with a long tail and a black face, which made him look like the old man of the mountains, he sat above us in a pine tree, nonchalantly watching our caravan descend the trail. Tibet is a paradise for chaps like him. Because of their deep-rooted belief in reincarnation, Tibetans avoid killing animals, birds and even fish. If one leads a pure life, he passes on at death to a higher form. If a person behaves badly in this life, he will be demoted in his next. Who knows? That big monkey might have been some Tibetan scale our wag great-great-grandfather. In any case, the Tibetans claimed descent from a monkey centuries before Darwin advanced his theory. According to one of their old chronicles, a monkey, who was an incarnation of Chenrezig, the god of mercy, met a female demon who was born in misery because of the wickedness of her former life. Out of compassion, the monkey married her. Six children were the result of this union. The father got rid of their tails and long hair by feeding them on sacred grain. And, says the old chronicle, these children were the ancestors of the Tibetans. On the way to the bottom of the Chumbi Valley, we rounded a bend 5 or 6 miles from the top of the pass. Just below, on a rocky ledge, glistened the golden roof of our first Buddhist monastery, Kharja Gompa, home of a sect of Red Hat monks. The Red Hats do not always practice celibacy. Many marry and have children. They may even have children out of wedlock. Once they ruled Tibet, but today they are in the minority. As we drew near the turreted, thick-walled building clinging to the side of the mountain, we could see the monks swarming about the courtyard. Near the entrance an aged priest was sitting on the ledge in the meditative posture of Buddha. He smiled and did not object when we turned our cameras his way. Several monks, led by an abbot in a gold hat, came to the main gate and urged us to stop for the night. We were behind schedule and reluctantly had to decline their invitation. But our one glimpse of that massive stone monastery gave us the feeling that we were indeed in mysterious Tibet. It would be impossible to venture more than a few miles into Tibet without recognizing the hold that religion and ritual have over the daily lives of all Tibetans. Nearly 1/5 of the males become monks. Although the monks are popularly called lamas by foreigners, the term lama is strictly applied only to the incarnate living gods, to the highest clergy and to saintly priests qualified to teach the doctrine. Run-of-the-mill monks are known as Drupa. The 200,000 or more monks are supported in their skyscraping and massive monasteries by the other 4 million of the population. The Dalai Lama, assisted by the foremost lamas and abbots and by a handful of noble families, rules the world's last theocracy. No impression of the country and its unique people, centuries removed from the Mishinyaj era, would be complete without some acquaintance with its religion. In view of the distinguished scholars who have devoted their lives to research on the subject, it is temerity on my part to discuss it. But in all humbleness, before traveling farther into Tibet, I shall attempt a brief outline of its religious background. In the early centuries of the Christian era, the Tibetans were a warlike people, composed of many loosely affiliated tribes. They waged victorious wars, frequently conquering their Central Asian neighbors. Their religion, known as Bon or P.A.-10, was a form of animism. They believed that spirits inhabited the mountains, rocks, lakes, rivers and trees, even the skies above and the earth below. They worshipped the good spirits and tried to placate the evil ones. They resorted to spells, magic and enchantments. In those days there were no monks, no monasteries, no temples. Witchcraft and sorcerers dominated the religious scene. In the middle of the 7th century, when the various tribes had united, Tibet had a powerful king, Song Tsongkhapa. His armies conquered western China and slices of northern India. Song Tsongkhapa then took as his two chief wives a Chinese princess and the daughter of the king of Nepal. They were both Buddhists. The Chinese princess brought with her a treasured Indian sandalwood image of Buddha. The Nepalese princess also brought as part of her dowry three precious Buddhist images. Working together, the two wives made the king an enthusiastic convert to Buddhism. With the new capital recently established at Lhasa, the two queens desired to erect temples that to enshrine their images. The Chinese queen built the Ramok Temple, still standing and containing a large image of the devout lady. For his Nepalese queen, Song Tsongkhapa himself constructed the famous Jokhang, since she was too poor to build a temple. Song Tsongkhapa was a zealous convert and not only gave the first impetus to Buddhism in Tibet, but founded the beginnings of its priesthood. Before the time of this great king, Tibet had no written language. Failure to translate the Buddhist scriptures brought from India, he sent one of his ministers to study in India and work out a Tibetan alphabet. Suitable written characters based on Sanskrit models were invented. Song Tsongkhapa is worshipped today as an incarnation of Chenrezig, the patron god of Tibet, the Lord of Mercy, the Avalokiteshvara of India, the compassionate Kuan Yin of China and Japan. There are two main divisions of Buddhism, the Hinayana, or lesser vehicle, and the Mahayana, or greater vehicle. The Hinayana claims to represent the pure teaching of Gautama Buddha, emphasizing the intellectual and rational side, and regarding the Buddha not as a god, but as a great human teacher and sage. The Mahayana puts a more mystical interpretation on the Buddhist doctrine, worships the Buddha as a divine being and offers salvation through faith and love as well as through knowledge. The Hinayana has flourished mainly in South Asia, the Mahayana, in the North. The comparatively optimistic and easygoing Mahayana Buddhism, introduced into Tibet, with its promise of salvation through faith and not so puritanical or severe in its demands as the older form, gradually appealed to the people. The P.A.-10 worshippers and the powerful P.A.-10 magicians fiercely fought the spread of Buddhism. But many of the 8th and 9th century kings gave it their support. The greatest of these were Tai Songditsen and Ralpakan, who combined military conquests with their Buddhism. Together with Song Tsongkhapa, they are worshipped by Tibetans to this day as the three religious kings, men of power. These three kings represented the final period of Tibet as a great military power in Central Asia. As Buddhism gained adherence in Tibet, the martial spirit declined. The late Sir Charles Bell, the eminent British authority on Tibet, was of the opinion that what Tibetans fear most in case of invasion is the loss of their holy religion and that the monks may be expected to fight for this. I quote an interesting passage from his Religion of Tibet, published in 1931, "There are many indications that the martial energy of the Tibetans, though sapped by Buddhism, has not even now been destroyed. Indeed, Tibet expects to fight later on for her religion. You can sometimes read in Tibetan books about the country called Shambhala. When people talk about it, they usually call it Shambhala of the North, and describe it as a mystical country which, 3 or 4 centuries hence, will be the scene of hostilities, fierce and decisive. One sees paintings representing the battle in Tibetan houses. Bodhisattvas are depicted as joining in the fray, in fact it is they who decide it. Shambhala lies somewhere to the northwest of Tibet. Dorjeev, the influential Mongol from Russian Mongolia, who used to hold a chair of philosophy at Lhasa, claimed that Shambhala is Russia. Under Taisong Ditsun, the celebrated tantric teacher, Padmasambhava, the lotus-born, was brought from India. He was believed to have occult powers to subdue evil spirits and demons. Tantrism, with its magic formulas and miracles, appealed strongly to the Tibetan masses, steeped in their old nature worship and fear of demons. Padmasambhava founded the first large monastery in Tibet in AD 749 at Same, a few miles southeast of Lhasa. The tantric Buddhism taught by Padmasambhava was combined with features of the original Bhiksen cult and developed into Lamaism. The Red Hat sect, followers of the early Buddhism of Tibet, revere him as their chief saint. Although Buddhism is practically extinct today in India, it was at that time the fountain of inspiration for all Buddhist countries. Many Indian holy men and sages, especially from northern India, where Tantrism flourished, were invited to India to spread their teaching. Tibetan monks likewise went to India to study at the feet of the masters and faithfully copy the old Buddhist scriptures into Tibetan. The tropical climate of India was almost unbearable for the Tibetans, accustomed to their cold, invigorating highlands. Many died, but a few returned with their precious translations. The scholarly monks of Sakya compiled the first authoritative edition of the Tibetan Buddhist canon. The Kaniya, the Tibetan Bible, is in 108 volumes, the Teniya, or commentaries, in 225 volumes. So faithful are the Tibetan translations to the Sanskrit originals, many of which were lost or destroyed in India, that Buddhist scholars today make every effort to gain permission to study rare treasures in the libraries of Tibetan monasteries. The Red Hats held sway for several centuries, but with increased riches they became indifferent to their duties and introduced unsavory practices which repelled some of the higher-minded among the clergy. At this period, in the middle of the 14th century, Tibet's greatest religious reformer, Tsongkhapa, the man from the land of onions, was born in the province of Amdo, near the Chinese border. He had his monastic training at Sakya and was determined to revive the religion in a purer form. His priests were celibate, abstained from wine, and were expected to lead simple and devout lives. He abolished the more extravagant and sensual tantras, preserving only the esoteric teachings of the tantric school. Tsongkhapa founded Ganden Monastery near Lhasa, to this day the third largest in all Tibet. The reformed sect was called Gelugpa, the Virtuous Way. Popularly, its followers were known as Yellow Hats, from the yellow hoods they wore, in contrast to the unreformed Red Hats. After some setbacks and conflicts with the Red Hats, the Yellow Hats finally gained the supremacy, which they hold to this day. A dwindling number of Red Hats still have their own monasteries, and sometimes they may be found dwelling amicably in cloistered peace with the Yellow Hats. The great reformer's successor, the son of a herdsman, founded the Tashi Lunpo Monastery, the Mount of Blessing, which was 7 years in the building. He had a reputation far and wide for his saintliness. Unfortunately, we did not see this monastery, near Shigatse, since it was 200 miles west of Lhasa and off our direct route to the capital. It is the traditional seat of the Panchen Lama, the Panchen Rinpoche as the Tibetans call him. The Panchen Lama is second in rank to the Dalai Lama, and in spiritual matters often considered his equal. But the Dalai Lama rules both in religious and temporal matters. Actually, nobody challenges any decisions of the God King in Lhasa. There has been no incarnation of the Panchen Lama at Tashi Lhunpo since 1924, when that living god fled to China because of a serious breach with the 13th Dalai Lama. The self-exiled Panchen Lama died in 1937. The Chinese communists recently got hold of a 12-year-old Tibetan in northwest China, and they have been pushing him forward as the reincarnation of the late Panchen Lama. The Chinese Reds have been trying to use the boy to stir up revolt in Tibet. For the long and intricate account of the development of Lamaism, the interested reader may turn to a number of authoritative books. Later on, in talks with everyday Tibetans, in our meeting with the Dalai Lama and others close to him, and in visits to the monasteries, I shall try to show something of the religion in present-day Tibetan life as my father and I observed it. 6. The Dalai Lama's passport. Leaving the Red Hat Monastery, we descended through a forest of fir trees. On the way to Yatung, we forded the swift, roaring Amur River, the first of the many tributaries of the Brahmaputra that we were to cross. Here again were many tall poles with prayer flags snapping in the wind. A little farther on we passed a number of pagode-like stone structures called khorsans, roadside religious shrines found near every Tibetan village and often containing sacred relics and images. Another common roadside shrine is the mani, or prayer wall. Everywhere along the road to Lhasa, especially at the approach to a village or a monastery, the traveler encounters these low walls, built of masonry and cement, into which stones have been inserted, carved with sacred texts, usually the favorite Om and Padme Hum. These walls often extend for a quarter of a mile or more. Pious Tibetans add to the walls and to the inscriptions to pile up Buddhist merit for themselves. Prayer walls, khorsans, monasteries, all hallowed objects, places, and even exalted persons must be passed so that they are on your right, as a sign of respect. The Tibetans have a proverb, "Beware of the devils on the left-hand side." On the outskirts of Yatung, I was startled when a young Chinese wearing black riding boots, a white sweater and broad-brimmed 10-gallon hat addressed me in perfect English, "Hello there, where are you going?" I learned from him that he was one of the Chinese who, as I explained in an earlier chapter, were being tossed out of Tibet, chiefly to give concrete evidence of Tibetan independence of Chinese or foreign influence. He was on his way to China. There were, I discovered, between 50 and 60 Chinese in Yatung, all fugitives from Lhasa. "How many Chinese are being ordered to leave Tibet?" I asked him. "All who are not traders," he replied. "What are you?" "I'm a trader." "What do you trade in?" "Oh, wool and other things." "If you are a trader, why must you leave?" "I don't know." He seemed ill at ease and forced to laugh. Later on we learned that he had been working in the Tibetan government. "Where did you learn to speak such good English?" Again he seemed disconcerted. "Oh, let's say I learned in India." Subsequently we were told that he came originally from Inner Mongolia, which is attached to Soviet Siberia, and that he had spent 5 or 6 years studying in Japan. Yatung is in a valley so deep that the sun does not appear until just before noon and is gone again 3 hours later. But with its colorful main street along the Amo, its orchards and flowers, and its snarling mastiffs, Tibet's fourth city is far less dismal than one would expect. It is a lively trading center and many of its residents are comparatively prosperous. After our meeting with the Chinese, our pack train continued through the cobbled streets to a charming house of log structure, the home of the Indian trade agent. Standing at the gate to greet us was a smiling Sikkimese in long, flowing robes, our genial English-speaking host, the Rai Bahadur Sonam. During dinner that evening at his home, conversation turned to the Tibetan attitude toward outsiders. The Rai Buddha told us that Tibet has no desire to change, the people want their way of life to continue unaltered. They think that foreigners have little to offer them and, in fact, can have only a corrupting influence. According to our host, the process of getting on in a modern country seems one awful rat race. The Tibetan wants no part in it, he wants to be shut off from the madness of the outside world and left alone in his mountains, where he can follow the good life of a Buddhist. This, he believes, will eventually free him from the cycle of reincarnation and deliver him into the Buddhist spiritual world, into Nirvana. In Tibet, the emphasis is on the spiritual rather than on the temporal. Tibetans cannot be blamed for trying to preserve the way of life that suits them. Perhaps they have the answer. Perhaps it would be a good thing for the world if, as the Rai Buddha put it, Tibet were left the one nation where life might continue unchanged from that of the earliest times. However, present-day obstacles may blast such a dream, notably Russia, of which our Yatung host said, it wants to meddle with every country's affairs, even with those of Tibet. We wondered if it could any longer be possible for a nation, no matter how remote, no matter how isolated by high mountains, to shut itself off from the problems of the world, especially in this age of high-speed, high-flying planes, radio shortwave, and atomic energy. To secure our Tibetan passport, the Lamayak the Rai Buddha Sonam introduced us to the local Tibetan trade agent, the Tromo Troki of Gomu. He appeared in official dress, a full-length blue robe wound with a red sash. His dark pigtail was coiled atop his head, and from his left ear dangled a 4-inch pendant of turquoise, pearl and gold. All this was crowned by a Western fedora. The one thing Western about which Tibetans are enthusiastic is the felt hat. Arriving with this impressive gentleman were three servants bearing gifts. One carried a tray piled with eggs, 100 or more of them, some fresh, some ancient. In Lamaland, as in China, they like them both ways. The next servant had a large shoulder of yak, all butchered and dressed. The third held a big bowl of yak butter. All these gifts were much appreciated, especially by our servants, who used the rancid yak butter for their all-important yak butter tea, the national drink of Tibet. As the Tromo Troki of Domu approached, he alternately stuck out his tongue and hissed at us. These gestures are marks of good manners and proper etiquette on the roof of the world. As we offered to shake hands with him, he passed a white silk scarf or kattu over our outstretched arms. This was our first experience with the novel Tibetan way of welcoming a visitor. We returned his courtesy by presenting him with a similar scarf from the supply we had brought from Sikkim. Then, from our box of gifts, we selected a gold-plated automatic pencil which could be adjusted to write in four colors, and we gave it to him as our present to the Dalai Lama's agent. Between sips of tea, he hissed politely at us to indicate approval of what we told him through our English-speaking host. The agent bestowed an unusual honor upon us by inscribing some Tibetan characters on our two American passports and stamping them with the ancient seal of the Lhasa government. We were told that this was the first time any passport had been so endorsed. What the Tromo Troki wrote may be translated as follows: Mr. Lowell Thomas, American citizen, has been permitted to visit Lhasa by the Tibetan government. Sealed by the Tromo Troki of Domu, dated the 17th day of the Tibetan 6th month of the Earth Bull Year. Tibet has worked out a unique calendar which has been in operation for 1,000 years. 5 elements are combined with 12 animals to designate the years. Every 60 years there is a complete cycle. The elements are earth, iron, water, wood and fire, and each element comes twice, first as male and then as female. The 12 animals: dog, pig, mouse, ox, tiger, hare, dragon, serpent, horse, sheep, monkey and bird change every year. Thus 1949 was the year of the Earth Bull, 1950 is the year of the Earth Female Tiger, 1951, the Iron Male Hare year. Yatung marked the end of the line for our Sikkimese mule train. The both the men and mules that had served us across Nathula turned back to Gangtok. Now we had to line up a new Tibetan pack train for the next leg of our journey, 8-day march to the town of Phari. The next morning we woke up to find our new transportation ready and waiting to load up. There were 16 pack animals to carry our 37 boxes of supplies, and 5 riding mules. From now on all our servants would ride too, Norbu, the cook, and Lajia, our bearer, as well as interpreter Tsuwong. But before we could get away, we had to await the arrival of the Lameetk, the document without which the traveler cannot proceed any farther inside Tibet. Shortly after breakfast the Tromo Troki brought us this Tibetan passport. It had been written with a bamboo pennon, the Tibetan script, which looks like Sanskrit, on a piece of parchment measuring 2 by 3 feet. We gathered round as the Tromo Troki opened up this scroll. Tsuwong translated it for us, from Domu, Yatung, right up to Lhasa. Let it be known to all Dzongs, officials, and to all others that a message has been received from the Tibetan government that 2 Americans, with an interpreter and servants, have permission to proceed to Lhasa, and that 16 pack mules and 6 riding animals be given to them, and coolies if required. Accounts for transport are to be settled by their armed escort, Chogpan Nima Jai Abu, at the local rate. On the route, preparation for lodging, servants for the kitchen, skin boats to cross rivers and any other requirements such as milk, eggs and vegetables are to be given to them at the current rate. The wishes of the 2 Americans are to be fulfilled at a moment's notice. For this journey let them be given everything without fail, as Americans are very good friends of Tibet. If they wish to proceed forthwith after arrival at each stage of the journey, let their wishes be gratified. When the Dalai Lama's passport was spread out before us, I could not help thinking that many Western explorers who had failed to reach Lhasa would have highly prized a document like this, guaranteeing safe conduct and the authority to procure supplies on the high road to the capital. Take W. Woodville Rockhill, who had a distinguished career as an American diplomat until his death in Honolulu on his way back to China in 1914. He had been United States Minister to China, and to several Balkan states, ambassador to Russia and to Turkey, and he occupied a number of other important posts. As an Orientalist and specialist on Tibet, his work is still highly regarded. From the time he was a boy he had been much interested in Tibetan Buddhism. As a young secretary of our legation in Peiping he devoted himself to a study of the Chinese and Tibetan languages, fluent in both. It was his heart's desire to explore unknown regions of Tibet and, above all, to visit Lhasa. So in 1888 Rockhill resigned his position in the diplomatic service and set out in December from Peiping by way of Kokonor, reaching the Tse Dam Basin in the border region the following spring. He dressed and lived like a Chinese frontiersman, a Mongol or Tibetan. By April he was well over the high ranges inside Tibet on his way to the capital. He had started out with £60 of silver and £20 of gold sewed in his clothing. But now his money was giving out, and also his animals and guides and provisions. So he had to abandon the road to Lhasa and turn southeast through the Kham country and back to China. He confessed, "I nearly starved to death. Time and again I was snowblind. I had to run for my life before the hostile lamas of eastern Tibet, and I vowed I would never go on another such fool's errand." But not even a year passed before Rockhill was again making arrangements to try his luck in the wilds of Tibet, push through to Lhasa and cross into India. He was only about 100 miles from the capital when he was ordered to go back. Unfortunately, Rockhill never realized his ambition to see the holy city. But his journeys into Tibet proved of real value to science. In addition to his descriptions of hitherto unknown nomad and mountain tribes, he carefully surveyed some 3,500 miles, crossed 6 Tainin passes, took sextant observation at 100 points, and collected from 300 to 400 ethnological, botanical and geological specimens. Then there was Dr. Sven Hedin, the eminent Swedish explorer of Central Asia and Tibet, who made his first journey into Tibet only a few years later than Rockhill and, like the American, had a burning desire to reach Lhasa. How he would have prized our passport. In the summer of 1896, Heedin established headquarters northwest of Tibet in the oasis of Khotan in the vast Tuklamakan desert of Chinese Turkestan, now Xinjiang. In this pleasant oasis he assembled his caravan. They crossed over the high passes to the crest of the vast northern Tibetan plateau and plugged forward in the face of violent gales, hailstorms, snow blizzards and cutting winds. On those bleak northern plains they did not meet a single human being for 55 days.